Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for Autumn Semester 2022. Today, market institutions and types. Usual routine is in play here. We're going to have a look at the markets today. They tried their best, but okay, we'll do it the easy way. Ma'am, is this a bull or a bear market day?
Bear.
Yeah, it's very bear. No, very bear. No, it's not very bear. Very bear, for heaven's sakes. But it tried to climb out of its pit earlier in the day here. But as you can see, the bears just at the end, they just whomped that market and slapped it down hard. And this is now the futures markets are taking it up. It's going to be a long, long night for if you're a bull, which is okay with me because I'm in a bear position. I took a hard bear position and it's paying off very well. And that's, you can do this, remember what I said, you can always make money in a market, if it's a bull market or a bear market. To an investor, that doesn't matter because we can play it either way and make good money. But of course, it's obviously timing. If you think it's going to be a bear market and you buy in on a bear position, you could end up having a bull market for a couple of days. Matter of fact, a few weeks ago, I knew there was going to be a bear surge, but I bought in too soon and the bulls were running and I lost some money. Fortunately, I wasn't sentimental. I got out as soon as I saw that happening. But yeah, you can do good in either kind of market. What's been happening here is the equities markets are obviously investors are getting out of them. Then the question would be, okay, they've got money, where are they going to put it? The safe harbor would be to go over and put that money into bonds. And we can look over here and see if bonds, how bonds are doing very quickly. Now if the yield, well, there we go though. The problem is that the bond yields are going up, but that means bond prices are going down. So investors are getting out of equities, but they're not putting the money into bonds. They're getting out of bonds too. So that means that's a second stage flight to quality. What's even weirder here is that these commodity markets are going down. So they're not going to the commodities. Remember, from stocks to bonds, bonds to gold. And if you're not going there, they're selling out of gold. Where in the world is that money going? The answer to that would be it's obviously they're going in, well, not obviously, they're going into money markets, essentially cash. And they're taking the money, they're not putting it into something else, they're just putting it under their mattress. And I'll talk about money markets later in this lecture or the next one, that is your sort of your safe harbor. If all else fails, put the money under your mattress and wait to see what happens next. And that seems to be what's going on now. There's a bearish sentiment and it's broad-based. So the professional investors are saying, we need to see what's going on. Clearly, well, if you know how these things work, the Federal Reserve is draining the liquidity out of the economy to get the inflation rate back under control. That means that supply of money is going down, price of money is, which is interest rates, is going up. Interest rates going up slows down an economy. So there is a sentiment right now that the Fed is serious. It's not going to get scared and pump money into the economy. It's just going to ride it. And it's going to push the economy. We're in a recession. Technically, we're in a recession. Two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth, that's a recession. So we have one. Is it going to be deep? Well, the longer the Fed has to clamp down on the money supply, the deeper the recession could get. We are hopeful that the markets are taking the Fed seriously and we'll be able to get this this liquidity overhang drained out within another quarter or two and go back to a strong growth. We have all kinds of mixed measures right now. Job growth is strong, but we also want to look at other factors too. Among them are durable goods purchases. In other words, the production of goods that last more than a year. Everything from washers and dryers to cars to factory equipment, backhoes, tractors, that's all durable goods. If those orders are still coming in strongly, that means that American businesses and American households are long-term bullish on the economy. So that's good news. That tends to fulfill itself. But if those are falling, that's a scare to us. That's a worry to us. The inflation numbers that come out every month, if we see those still showing high numbers, that means that the Fed has a lot of reason to keep that money supply going down. If the inflation rate begins to back down, that means that the Fed's horizon is shorter, and then it can let up and we can get back onto a normal path. As a financial economist, where do I see it? I see it, I'm bullish in the long run, but for the short run, for the next 4 to 6 months, it's still bearish, and I think I'm reflecting also what a lot of the people on Wall Street are thinking too. We got short-term pain for long-term gain. The good news for you is that when you go out there, about the time you'll be going out there to get your career jobs, we should be back in a fairly strong economy. And that's good news for you as far as getting a job and getting a darn good salary when you get a job. So, I'm a bear in the short run, but I hate to say it, but I am an optimist in the long run. Now, if we go over here and look at the Financial Times, London and Tokyo. First, Tokyo, last night, they had something knock the hell out of their market, the 225, and then they crawled out of it. But after that, it just kind of, there was no new information. So they finished the day kind of flat. It has to have information for it to go up or down. If there's nothing new, or if there's a balance of good and bad, then it'll just kind of float from where it was. That's what we saw in Tokyo. Then we come over to London. The sun came up in London, and the bears immediately, something had spooked the hell out of them. They drove it down. Then there was no information. And then there was some optimism, but that fizzled out at the end. They were dropping hard. Come over here to the sun went down in London and came up over here. And that negative sentiment just, at first it was negative, and then there was a bullish little piece. And then from there, it tried a rally, late morning, midday rally. That fizzled. The bears came, and at the end, something really spooked the bears. The closing bell was with a lot of sell orders coming in. You can see that on that spark chart. You see that bears drop there at the end. And in the aftermarket, it's just as bad. I'll show you, and for God's sake, don't follow me on investments. But this is a bear position. It's a long position. In other words, it's a buy position, but it's a long bear position. And there are several of these. There's one SPXS. You buy this if you're a bear. So it went up during the day because it was a bear. For some reason, it's gone down a little in the aftermarket. Here's another one, SPXU. See, oh God, that one was up a lot. See the bear, it's a bear position. So if the bears are winning, you win with this kind of an investment. And interestingly, both of these are slightly negative. So I don't know what, that might just be like me. I'm going to sell out. I'm going to sell the hell out. I've gotten enough aggravation scare. Here's another one. These are, I'm just showing you, You can make money if you're a bear, and it doesn't have to be short positions. It can be long positions. Go long SQQQ. Strange. They're all doing that. See how the bears were winning all day? But something has, I swear, I think it's just like my sentiment. I put in a sell order to get out. You know, I've had enough excitement from this, and I've made my money. You can't get sentimental about this. Well, it's a bear market. I'm just going to keep holding on. No, you got to have a trigger. When you get scared enough, you just get out of it, collect your money, and go on and do something else with your life for a while. And that's what it looks like. They must be doing what I'm doing. I put in a sell order. They're putting in sell orders, too. Just irritates the hell out of me. Their sell orders are going to get beat mine. I'm going to lose a little bit of my capital gain. But again, the whole point, though, is that you put in $200, and you come out a few days later with maybe $250, $300. That's kind of like day trading, but it's not exactly day trading because you're not doing it on swings of a day. You're holding on, and you're playing in cycles of the market. Enough of that. Let me show you something. Let me look at a stock here, a couple of stocks, just to keep reminding you of this. Ford. Just to keep you in that flow of thinking about this kind of stuff. You notice that Ford followed the market, but is Ford a risky stock or a safe stock? What would you say, sir? Risky or safe? Good. The beta is above 1.0, so it's a risky stock. No doubt about that. This would be what we call an aggressive stock, an aggressive investor, a bullish investor would be in something like this. This is actually a little beyond your normal investor. When you get up there to 1.25, above that, that's scary. But here's the weird thing about this stock. There's another measure of risk here that you can look at. It's not as professional, but we look at it, we think about it. See that PE ratio? Now, long, long time ago, in the 90s, I would have said a PE ratio above 10. Now I say a PE ratio above 30. If a PE ratio is above 30 or so, we consider that risky. Below 30 is not risky. Let me explain what it means. And ride with me. I'm going to repeat this three times, and then I'll just keep saying it over and over again until you get kind of the hang of it. The price to earnings, you take the price per share divided by the earnings per share. What that is telling us is the amount of money investors are currently willing to pay for $1 of shareholder money. The PE ratio is how many dollars investors are currently willing to pay for $1 of current shareholder earnings or money. The PE ratio is the number of dollars investors are willing to pay, are currently willing to pay for $1 of the company's current shareholder earnings or money. Essentially, if I see this, investors are right now thinking that every dollar that Ford gets to the bottom line that belongs to the shareholders, every dollar that Ford brings to the bottom line, it's going to turn into a present value of $5 for the shareholders. So when I see this $5, essentially what investors are saying is, we think that every dollar Ford got for us, made for us, it paid all its bills, this is our money, it will turn into $5. Now that's not a lot. you'll see some of these. I mean, you get up there, it's amazing. There were, back in the day, there were companies with price-earnings ratios. There was one on the Tokyo Exchange that had a P.E. ratio of 250,000. In other words, investors thought that every dollar that company made for the shareholders, it was going to turn into $250,000 for the shareholders. Well, of course, the company went bankrupt within a couple of months. That's just ridiculous. But today, you'll see them all over the place, these P.E. ratios. Let me show you a couple more. But notice here, that's actually a very low number for a company like Ford. Five? I mean, yeah, Ford has had some controversial decisions it's made lately, like the one about electric cars, and the one, you know, that Ford is no longer going to produce any cars except for the Mustang. It's going to an all truck company, except for Mustangs. So that was kind of controversial there. So, you know, but still, I mean, I mean, I'd be scared about that beta, but I see that price able to go up quite a bit, bring that up higher than five. See, price over earnings, as the price goes up, the P.E. ratio goes up. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, I could see that P.E. ratio telling me that that price could has room on the upside. You notice even the Yahoo analysts are saying, yeah, I mean, that, they're thinking 16. I'm thinking more like if a P.E. ratio of, if I want a P.E. ratio of 10 on earnings per share of 280, I could see that price going maybe as high as $30, $35. Is it going to do that? Hell, I don't know. I'm just a professional analyst. You know, if I was that good at it, like I said, I wouldn't be teaching. Well, I'd still teach here because I love you guys to death. No. But see, the thing, though, is that I see that P.E. ratio as kind of like maybe more of a short-term price spike kind of thing. And the beta is more the long haul. This is risky. You know, it's sort of like this. Let me ask this. Have you ever dated a serial killer? I mean, obviously, that's a really risky thing to do as a long-term relationship, you know, buy a house and all that. But wouldn't it be fun for a couple of days? Don't tell me it wouldn't, you know. Prowling up and sneaking up to people and saying, "Boogie, die!" No, that's what I'm trying to get at, though. You know, for these risky companies, that P.E. ratio can be sort of a flag that there's some short-term price appreciation that isn't embedded there right now. Now, I'm talking like an elf, an analyst, a technical analyst. But at the same time, this is a good thing. Let me show you some other companies. Oftentimes, the beta and the P.E. will agree with each other completely. That's usually the case. Let me show you one. Let's look at Tesla. Yeah, they're agreeing. Beta is technically, the technical term is risky AF. Yeah, that's a beta of 2.18, really, and a P.E. ratio of 100. Who buys a 100 P.E. ratio? I mean, just on the P.E. ratio alone, to get its way back down to the typical auto company, that price is going to have to drop by down to about 70, 60 a share. Will it? No. Why not? Because the Wall Street fund boys, fund managers, they've put way too much money into this company to let it fall. Because if Tesla goes to its intrinsic value, you'd have maybe four, possibly five or six big houses on Wall Street just buckle right there. That'd be the end of them. The ripple effect would be staggering. They're not going to let it happen. They'll keep that price up there. So there's that. Look at another one. Kellogg. Yeah, see, price-earnings ratio and the beta are compatible for that company. But if you look at a company like, well, actually, I'm kind of curious, mRNA. That's Moderna, one of the vaccine makers. Holy. Well, spank me Buddha. Look at that. Do you see that? That is a big distinction. I mean, that beta says yeehaw, and that price earnings ratio says hello kitty. I mean, that something's going to give there. And probably the price is going to pop at some point. But who knows? You know, but no question about it, this is risky. Really risky. 1.6, that's pro territory. That's when you have had one too many Adderall in the last hour. Okay? So, but the PE ratio is saying there's price up movement on the price. And look at that earnings per share. You can't beat that. $31.73. That is per share what belongs to the shareholders. That's after the bills have been paid. So the residual claim that I talked about last week, that's after that. This belongs, $31.73 per every share belongs to the shareholders. That's a profitable, a hella profitable company. And, oh, for God's sake, why do they show those ads? Really? Anyway. What was I thinking before I was distracted there? Okay, so you got a little bit more. Every day I'm going to do this with you. My purpose is to get you out of here in a position where you have strength in thinking about investments and thinking about how markets work and begin to understand this vast ocean in which you are becoming a part, and you can either be its slave or its master. And there you go. The master, captain of an ocean, of a ship, doesn't fight the ocean. He or she knows how to use the ocean to get to a destination. So you remember that. That's why I'm doing this. And take it for what you want. Now I'm going to go back and I'm going to be a little bit more detailed in talking about financial markets and getting a little bit into the institutions that are behind the markets. But remember, a market is any place where buyers and sellers come together. It's any place. It could be a physical platform. It could be online and all of that kind of stuff. The funniest thing about it is that textbooks are usually almost always written by professors or by retired people in industries. And there is this underlying foundation, you know, where we all stand on the shoulders of all of this tradition and these terms and formulas. But you see a lag in sometimes you see a real lag in how the textbooks pick up what is currently happening. And that's the case in here, where you see that they don't mention these new markets, which are not physical markets, they are virtual markets. And in fact, they're not even, like, I'm not even talking about e-commerce. I mean, e-commerce is huge now, but it's not as big as it's going to be, because a lot of companies still don't understand the potential for their platforms. But there's another part of this virtual world, too, that doesn't even have anything that seems to be of value. You probably know about games where you can buy virtual real estate or virtual weapons with actual money, with real money. You can buy real estate in several games and acquire vast tracts of land. And there's no land there. There's nothing. It's just in virtual space. Not too long ago, this virtual horse racing site, there was someone who sold a virtual horse for $250,000 real dollars. I mean, real dollars for a horse that doesn't exist. It doesn't. I mean, they had a picture. I wanted to click on the image, but I was afraid I was going to see a Sparkle Pony, or something like that. Princess Sparkle Pony. I mean, nothing there. Have any of you ever heard of NFTs, non-fungible tokens? I sell them. I've got some of my artwork. I've got five pieces that are NFT. One of them sold. The buyer, I don't know who it was, the buyer got nothing. They didn't even get a print. They didn't even speak to me. I have no idea who it was. Someone bought a non-fungible token, an NFT, and there's nothing there. There's nothing. They looked at a picture and they said, I like this. So they paid me just so they could say, I have an NFT that says, late on an October prairie afternoon. That's all they have. Nothing else. So, I mean, you got the old timers in finance saying, the world is going to hell. This is a sign of the rapture coming. Not really. It's just weird as hell. But this is a market now. These virtual markets that have no physical thing associated with them at all. Now, smart contracts are another part of this, but smart contracts, you're actually doing just a virtual contract with pledges that are in cryptocurrencies, but there are physical goods or intellectual property that is actually exchanged. So there's another one, the smart contracts, but then the NFTs, the non-fungible tokens, are out there too. That's pure virtual. Those are markets. They don't mention them in the book, but I do want to let you know that the world is moving on. These things they talk about in the book, they are there. And they are huge, vast oceans. Many of these markets, you're talking about quadrillions of dollars. And it's all around us all the time. And most people don't actually know that. And it's kind of a leap in your minds when you come to a place like this to be able to see that world does exist, because they have no idea it exists whatsoever. Not even a clue that world does exist out there. I'm going to start with the one for physical goods. These are markets. Really? Is it that hard to have a marker here? Yeah, I noticed it gave me let me have a marker. And it's one that doesn't work, so I got my own. So as far as markets are concerned, these are more of the traditional ones. I put it as a side note, also virtual markets. But here, the first one is obviously the physical market. I work at a McDonald's. You drive through. You say, I would like a McCheeseburger, McPlease. I say, why, McExcellent. Would you like McFries with that, McSir? And you say, McYes. Okay, that's a physical transaction. Thing of value for thing of value. Money, you feel it. Burger, you taste it. And it's delicious. Double quarter pounder with cheese, extra pickles. You are a grain trader and you want to get put in an order. You're a grain trader for Kellogg and you are going to contact a broker and say, I want to buy 10,000 bushels of wheat. I say, give me 5 minutes and I contact you, done. Money transfers from your account to my account, and I direct a ship to take that grain to you. Physical markets. You want to buy a house. Okay? I sell you a house. I get money from you. You get a house from me. It's haunted, demonic possession and all that, but that's not my problem. anymore, except for that relative who got possessed and she's still down in the basement somewhere. But that's not here. Okay. Now there's another, and obviously also there are these intellectual property markets where there is not one side of the contract isn't a physical thing. Like intellectual property, for example, would be one. Or selling the rights to music. That would be a market that's not physical, at least on one side. There's money physical on one side, but on the other side there is just a right to have something, to do something. Now the next one is, the book actually uses the wrong term. And I will use the right term, but if you're doing homework, you'd have to use their term. There's a spot market versus a forward market. Now the book calls this futures market. But actually, futures are only one type of forward contract. Forward contracts are extraordinarily common. You will engage in forward contracts through your life, but you probably would never be told that they're forward contracts. In business, we know they're forward contracts. And let's do it this way. Okay. You, madam, you are a famous coffee roaster. You have a ginormous shop in Chicago. Everyone comes to drink your coffee and your lattes and all of those kinds of delicious drinks that make me fat, because I like all the fat ingredients in them. Okay, you need a lot of coffee beans to do your roasting and then make that into delicious coffee. So you look at you gotta have beans, but maybe you don't need them right away, but you're looking at right now, beans would go for $4.80 per pound. And you wanna buy 5,000 pounds. Now you can buy that at spot. In other words, $4.80 is spot. You buy gasoline at spot. You buy that cheeseburger at spot, the prevailing price now. But instead you call me because you know that you don't need those beans for a few months, 6 months. I am a coffee plantation owner in Central America. Hello. You say, hi, I want to buy 5,000 pounds of your coffee beans, Guatemalan, and I want to have them delivered in 6 months. So we make an agreement. That I say, okay, in 6 months, I shall sell you 5,000 pounds of coffee at $4.90 a pound. And you say, done. That's a forward price. You are figuring that the price of coffee when you need it is going to be way up. So that seems reasonable to you. Me, I figure it's probably going to go down. So this is reasonable to me. So let's talk about what happens at the six-month mark. Suppose that coffee has gone up to $5.10 a pound. So, if I, the plantation owner, sold at spot, I would make $5.10, but I've already contracted with you to sell at $4.90. So the seller here loses 20 cents a pound, loses 20 cents per pound. The buyer, who would have paid $5.10, saves 20 cents a pound. Make sure you understand that. Okay? Now, let's take it the other way. Suppose that the price of coffee dropped to $4.60 per pound. In this case, the seller who would make only $4.60 on spot gets $4.90. So the seller gets a bonus 30 cents per pound over spot. And the buyer, on the other hand, who could have bought the coffee at $4.60, is obligated to buy at $5.10. So the buyer loses 30 cents per pound. Is that right? Because buyer could have bought at $4.60, but pays $5.10. No, pays $4.90. Yeah, we're good. So one way or the other, there's a winner and there's a loser in a forward. But actually, no, there is not. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why forward contracts are so freaking popular. When you bought this coffee, you obviously are a good business person. You had my finance class, so you're a genius at finance, or not. But you know, you see, when you bought that coffee, you did not know what the cost of that coffee would be when you bought it 6 months later. So that 6 month projection, you're guessing at the cost. But with the forward contract, you're not guessing at all. You know exactly what the cost is. You have taken away the risk of coffee price volatility. Knowing exactly what a volatile cost is, but you don't, it's not volatile to you because you know exactly what it is. You have gold because you have certainty, whereas you would have had complete uncertainty 6 months prior. You know, so you can project. Okay, we got this cost coming up. We know what the cost is. You don't have a guess. Well, it might be up, might be down. No, it's there. And for on the other side, me, the seller, well, it looks like I got a bad deal when the coffee went up in price. I could have sold it at a higher price at spot. But actually, that's not really true. You see, because 6 months earlier, I already knew exactly how much revenue I was going to get. I already knew exactly the revenue. It wasn't a guess. It wasn't a mathematical projection. I knew what the bill was going to be. Certainty is gold. Risk is in and of itself a cost. Later in the course, when I cover risk in a few weeks, risk is by definition when there is more than one possible outcome. That's risk. And so if both sides of this contract have removed risk from the deal. In both cases, we have numbers that we would not have had before. Numbers with absolute certainty. Now let me tell you how powerful this is. These futures contracts. Now a futures contract is a forward contract that has very strict numbers in it. Forward contracts can be for any amount, any price, you know, all that. But futures contracts are highly structured, a specific amount to be delivered by the contract itself, not by your negotiations, by the contract. A delivery date by a contract that is traded on a big exchange with guaranteed payments and a middle person, so there isn't any face-to-face negotiation. So futures contracts are just highly structured forward contracts. And if you're interested in that, I usually teach a class in derivatives. Futures are a type of derivative. The math can scare the hell out of you at first, but once you get past that, this is a rush play in the futures contract world. Anyway, now, suppose that, I don't know, who looks this part? You, sir, you're a farmer. You're a corn farmer. You grow corn. That is your business. Well, actually, you know, you're a farmer, so it's your business. You put the D in business. Okay, your business is corn. If corn prices go up, you make a great amount of money for the year. If corn prices go down, you are in really hurt for the year. I am a corn futures trader, and I can say to you, and we're doing this now, more and more farmers are going with us. I can make it so that if corn prices go up, you lose on my futures contract. You say, well, what the hell is that good? But if corn prices go down, you win on my futures contract. So in other words, regardless of what corn prices do, you know how much you're going to make at the end of the year. You see, you are a corn farmer. You agreed with me. You're a corn farmer. You are not a corn price speculator. That's not your job. You grow corn, and you grow damn fine corn. I mean, that sweet corn of yours, you roast that stuff, and you dip it in a big vat of melted butter. Good stuff. You don't know about corn price volatility. You don't care about it. So I can make it so that I can put you in a contract so that up or down is down or up, so that you know, you can't do it perfectly, but you can know pretty well how much you're going to make for the year. And the cool part about that is, yeah, you could have become made a fortune, but you also could have been taken into pure bankruptcy if corn prices fall too much. I can guarantee you that that will not happen. Because as low as corn goes, that's the more you make on that contract of mine. So you understand that this is a powerful mechanism for risk management. The term for this is hedging. And companies hedge everything you could imagine. A truck company is in the business of truck driving. When diesel prices go down, the company makes more money. But if diesel prices go up, the company makes less money. The company shouldn't be worried about price volatility of distillates. All I do is make sure that if diesel prices go up, they lose, but they win on the contract. If diesel prices go down, they win on the cost, but they lose on the contract. That way, the diesel price price of diesel fuel no longer impacts on the net income. It is no longer a factor. And you can do the trucking, which is what you are in the business of doing. That's what these futures and forward contracts can do, is they can take away a risk that is not part of, should not have even been part of your business model. And it's a kind of a difficult thing these days, is because so many generations have gone with this idea that, yeah, the price volatility of corn, the price volatility of fuel, the price volatility of grain, whatever, is just part of our business. No, it's not. And how do I know that? Because I can make it go away and your business will still do well. That's the cool thing, is that it's kind of opening up a world to businesses to understand better what constitutes what we call in business the core competency of the company, so that they can focus on what matters to them and stop freaking out about all these things that are beyond their control. Whether you make money or lose money is kind of in your control, as long as things that are out of your control are taken out of the equation. So just know that, okay? It's worth it for you. I'll give you one more example. Back when I was in the oil and gas business down in Texas, I worked with five others. We ran a wildcat operation. You know, you punched a whole lot of dry wells and miserable, hot, god-awful scorpions, armadillos, snakes, and most of the time you didn't hit. But once in a while, you'd punch and you'd get oil. Now, I'm not talking about these gushers spraying. You know, you were usually pulling this ugly, sour, hot, horribly smelly crude that had been made from dinosaur and vegetable rot over millions of years. But it was oil. And what you did was you capped, you put your pump jack on, got a flare tip out there to burn off the gas, and then the oil was went through pipes into storage tanks. Now, every once in a while, the Cocaline truck would come by and buy your oil. Now, the Cocaline truck, you could do one of two things. You could have the Cocaline driver pay you spot, whatever it was per barrel, for that grade of crude, or you could go into a contract. So in other words, let's say that oil was $18 a barrel spot. Okay, well, that's great. He comes, I get $18 a barrel. But he could also say, tell you what, 6 months, every time I come out here, you get $17.50 a barrel, guaranteed. Okay, why would I want to do that? Well, what happens if oil drops to $10 a barrel? I mean, if you're taking spot, you're dog meat. You're dead. You can't even pay the lease payments on that equipment, on that ETC, equipment trust certificate. So what you do is, but of course, if oil goes to $30 a barrel, you're going to say, well, shit, I didn't get that because I was contracting at $17.50. But you see, that took the risk out of it. We weren't in the business of speculating on oil prices. We were oilmen. We just punched holes in the ground and to see if there was anything down there that looked black and stinking. So you understand, this is the way you get out of risks. It's through this market. Buyers of risk and sellers of risk. That corn farmer is a seller of risk. On the other side of the contract is a speculator betting against you on risk. Just pure risk, a gambler. A highly trained, highly liquid gambler. Okay, enough of that. Now, another one is primary versus secondary. I'd already brought this one up to you. And this has to do with securities. A primary market is when the seller of the security is the company. That's a primary market. If you were to buy in the IPO of, let's say, Lyft, L-Y-F-T, okay, I would have bought in the primary market. But if I just go on and call my broker and say, buy a one-round lot Lyft at market, fill or kill. Well, it wouldn't be if it's a market. Well, I mean, that's just a secondary. Someone who owned the stock who bought it, selling to someone who wants the stock. That's a secondary market transaction. As I told you before, it is very unlikely in your life you will ever engage in a primary market transaction. You want to borrow $500 million. I'm rich. I could do it, but I won't. Because you're going to sell it to an investment banker. He'll give you the $500,000, and then he'll see if I want to buy it from him. So by the time that bond, $500 million bond, gets to me, it's a secondary market transaction, not primary. Now, just to make this clear, securities markets, primary market transactions, are governed by the Securities Act of 1933. That's primary market. Secondary market transactions are governed by the Securities Act at the federal level, I should say, by the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Let me explain in more depth. The 1920s was, in fact, the Roaring Twenties. The rich got richer, the poor got poorer. We had three presidents in a row who were pro-business, ultra-conservative. The best market is a free market. The only good government is no government. Government should be small enough to be drowned in a bathtub. Rich people making money, the money will trickle down to the poor and the working class. That was the 1920s. The rich were getting filthy rich, the poor were getting poor. There were fraud, conspiracy, scams, Ponzi schemes, pyramid schemes of all kinds, liars, cheats, dog beaters, basic grifters, thieves. They ran the country and Wall Street and Main Street. The banks were corrupt. The judges were corrupt. The Congress and the presidents were corrupt AF at that time. And finally, it all buckled in the crash of 1929. And in 1932, the next election, all of the SOBs were thrown out. They were thrown out on their ear. And a whole wave of reformers came in. And I'm not talking about reformers, Obama, Biden types of reformers. I'm talking about hardcore. Kill them all, let God sort them out. They passed legislation cracking down on the securities industry, cracking down on the banks, cracking down on all the ways that companies abused workers, cracking down on all the liars and schemers and scammers. It was glorious to behold what happened at that time. And these were the securities end of that, where a lot of the lying and cheating and stealing was going on. And so these laws controlled, put that under tight federal control. And there's also state control, too, that followed along with it as reformers came into the state legislatures as well. But make sure, know that it wasn't just security, stocks, bonds, all that kind of stuff. It was banking was brought under control because of all of the insane abuse in the banking industry. Labor relations were brought under control. Safety, child labor laws were enacted, minimum wages. Unions were allowed to function without getting the crap beaten out of them whenever they opened their mouths. It was quite a time, quite a time. But now, let me get down to this. The primary securities market, governed by the Securities Act of 1933, put a very strict rein on private and public transactions in securities. And I'll use the example of stocks. You'll hear me say stocks, but it also applied to bonds and exotic instruments as well to some extent. Now, a private transaction in stock. Let me try it this way. Madam, I should like you to be one of my owners. Share with me the glory of my company. I'll sell you 100 shares of stock for $5,000. Okay? Now, first of all, oh, wait, I'll sell you some stock too, ma'am. And you over there. And I'll call some friends over on the West Coast, and I'll sell that stock to them. Well, the truth of the matter is you probably broke the law, and you would suffer, at a minimum, civil penalties, surrender of the proceeds, and you might go to prison for what you just did. You can't just say, I want to raise money, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to sell stock. No, there are exemptions under the Securities Act of 1933, and I'll go through those in a minute. But as a general rule, you can neither offer to sell nor solicit offers to buy stock without registering it with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the state of the citizens in which you are going to offer or solicit offers. You cannot do it. You just can't. In my business, when I was a consultant, there were a number of times when companies, these executives, they were idiots. They called me and they said, you know, we sold some stock and someone told us that we were supposed to do some little thing with the feds, the government. Yeah, you were supposed to have filed to get permission to do this and to make all these disclosures for the purpose of providing information that was unbiased to your investors. You didn't do that? Well, no one told us. You know, if we don't know the law, how are we supposed to obey the law? Well, that's a good question. You can ask that to your fellow inmates. You know, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to kill that man, so how was I supposed to know I couldn't kill that man? Good for you. Ignorance of the law is not going to be an excuse. So in other words, if you are going to sell stock to the public, you must go through a whole hell of registration requirements. And that was one of the things that I did as a consultant for small companies. I kept them from getting into trouble. And unfortunately, if they were already out of compliance, it was just like, I'd say, I don't know you, because whoever was in their path was probably going to get in trouble. Even if I would come in to try to fix it, they'd probably have kicked my ass. But okay, so if you're going to do a public offering, that means that you can freely trade the stock back and forth with other people. You have to go through all of these hoops with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the states in which solicitations for offers or buys were made. You have to do it. It's not an option. Now, however, there are exemptions. There are exemptions. And they are carved out under regulations by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, the first level of those, okay, know this. If you buy stock in a private transaction, it is called restricted. And if you have a physical stock certificate, it has to have a big red stamp saying restricted on it. And you can only get rid of that under Rule 144. And that's a big jump right there. Or you have to register it later. So a private transaction can be done. It can be done. The stock is restricted. That means you can't buy or sell it. You can't sell it to someone else. It's restricted. You're stuck with it until you can get it registered and get that restricted stamp pulled off with a new cert. Okay, so private transactions can be done. There are several. There are three under what is called Regulation D, Reg D. The first one is a weird one, and I used it six times. Four of the times were successful. It's called the $1 million offering. And if your company meets some pretty strict criteria, you can sell up to $1 million, raise up to $1 million in a stock offering without registering it with the mess. You still have to fill out some forms, but it's super easy. And the stock is freely tradable. It's called the $1 million offering. And there were a couple of companies, six in all. One of them, just an example, came and they had contacted me through a mutual acquaintance, and they said, we need to raise $250,000. We went through all of the check boxes and filled out the necessary forms, and it was so easy, it was just ridiculous. And then we went out, I said, well, you know, I'm not going to be able to find an investment banking house. You're going to have to do this yourselves. They asked me if I would help, and I said, hell no, I'm not going to get involved in that. But they managed to do it, and it was a full subscription. Now, once you say, this is what I have to raise, this is what I want to raise, if you don't make that, then the offering failed. Now, know this, a term, and I'll bring this one up again later. The selling document for a full-blown public offering is called a prospectus. It's a thick book that you have to give to any potential investor who requests it. It is full of financial statements, projections, disclosures. I mean, you have to give them your belt size. But so that's a prospectus. Now, with this Reg D 504, it's a mini prospectus. They call it an offering circular. It's a very cool document, and I put together some of those. Back in that time, my printers looked like they were professional compared to everyone else's back in the 80s, but you have to make it look nice, and you give that to potential buyers of your stock. And there's really not, the only real restriction is that you have to make sure that you've put this form in the hands of all of the states of citizens where you will sell this. Like if I were to do this from Illinois, and I was going to sell in Wisconsin and Missouri and Indiana, I would have to file this Reg D 504 disclosure thing. It's not much with all of those states. I'm going to try to sell my stock to citizens in your states and in Illinois too. But anyway, the Reg D, the 504 actually creates freely tradable public stock. Weird thing. Now the other two are pure private, 505 and 506. They apply, you are exempt. You don't have to register anything if your investors meet certain levels of sophistication. In other words, you can say, this is a Reg D 506 offering because I am going to sell the stock only to people who have a net worth of over $20 million, something like that. It's restricted. Understand it's restricted stock, but these are the kind of investors who would understand that they can't just go out and sell the stock later. Now under 506, and full disclosure, I'm behind the times. I stopped doing this some years back, but I don't know the numbers now. But if I'm not mistaken, under a 506, you can't do it to more than like 37 investors. That's how many you can have. However, they don't have to be all sophisticated. You can bundle investors under a single sophisticated investor if that sophisticated investor has sufficient demonstrable influence over the investments of the people under him. So in other words, I could sell it to you because you're a multimillionaire, but you know this loser who makes $5,000 a year, and you've talked him into joining. Turns out he's actually worth more than you, but his business we can't talk about because, you know. And anyway, you understand that you could bundle him so that I could get money from both of you, counting only you as a sophisticated investor. So there are these tricks you can do in this kind of world. And then there's another one, a completely different regulation. Now we call this the Bob Marley registration because it's reggae. Get it? Reggae. Bob. The hell with it. Reggae allows you to raise a lot of money, but it's up to a limit how much you can raise. Offering circular, restricted stock, but you are kind of loose on whom you can sell it to. And here's the nasty part about it. Here's a funny story. There was a beer company. Its beer was getting very popular, kind of with a mid-level beer drinker. You know, they're not totally, you know, hillbilly, but they're not upscale. So this beer was getting very popular. So they had this idea. They were going to offer stock in reliance on Regulation A. And how did they do it? They put an offering circular in each of their six-pack bottles of beer. So these people were just sitting there getting themselves, you know, blottoed. And they, well, look at this. This company's got damn good beer and they're selling stock. I think I'll buy some of their stock. It worked too well. The company oversubscribed by millions of dollars. They didn't know any better. Wow, look at all this money that's coming in. We're rich. We're going to be able to build that second and third brewery and everything. Well, the SEC got wind of it and said, no, you're not. You're going to give every penny of this stock back. And you're also going to pay a fine. And we're still deciding whether we're going to send your officers and directors to prison. Why? Because you said Regulation A, you relied on it, and you oversubscribed way above the cap, the limit. It was phenomenal. I mean, it was essentially the SEC was sending a message to the entire corporate world, don't do this. I mean, the company survived but it was crippled for years from that experience. So restricted offerings are restricted. You're relying on an exemption from the overall requirement that you register. So if you're going to rely on that exemption, you stick to the rules of that exemption. I mean, there were two companies where the $1 million offering, hell, I could have gone $4-5 million on two of them. It killed me because it was already I'd already invoked 504, filled out the paperwork. So at the $1 million level, literally they had to send checks back. That was before there was electronic stuff. Literally they had to send checks back and say, I'm sorry, we've subscribed. It's subscribed out. And that was it. And the one guy, he understood why we were doing it, but he called me a son of a bitch a couple of times. He said, you know, we could be a lot better off if you hadn't said that. I said, yeah, I would have been visiting you in prison, Cupcake. But anyway, this is how that world works out there. So do know that there are avenues to raise capital. Don't be stupid. You see that Shark Tank thing? You know, we've got a company that started with students here, Packback is it called? Yes. As a matter of fact, I was one of the people that when they were first talking about this as a project here for a class, I was one of the judges, if I recall correctly. But okay, yeah, they got all that money. Well, how did they get all that money? Who was the one who gave them the money to get it going? Do any of you know? Who was?
Mark Cuban.
Bingo, Yahtzee. You think Mark Cuban would fit under Reg D 507, 506? Yeah, he would. He could put, Mark D has enough money, he could have bought the SEC. Yeah, so you see those very super rich investors or those shows where you have someone who reviews these different projects and says, I'll put money into this one or that one. I mean, those are fun to watch, but you've got to understand that they're not just out there soliciting money from Joe and Ethel. They are soliciting money from sophisticated investors. So those are Reg D 506 or Reg A or something like that. They are operating under clearly defined, and their lawyers have said, yes, you qualify to make this investment, and the company, yes, you qualify to accept this investment. Those are so there's a lot of technical legality hiding under the surface in these stories that you generally don't hear about so much. But if you're going to go out there and do this kind of thing, by all means do it, but you're going to have to do it with people who, you're going to have to talk to the kinds of people who know how to do it. And unfortunately, if you go with a lot of those people, I'm not talking about Shark Tank and things like that, but if you go with those who broker this, I was one of the Rain Men who did these deals. They're going to take a massive penny from you. I'll tell you a story later in this semester where we made a deal with a guy who needed $5 million, and what we did was we raised $7 million for him, and he had a fit. Why are you doing that? I said, $5 million. Yeah, $2 million is ours. Are you okay with that? No, go away. Get the hell out of here. So we left, and he came running out crying, and we cut him a deal, which was what we were playing to anyway. 6.5. You're on the hook for $6.5 million, and all you're going to get is $5 million because we brought money to the table you never would have dreamed of getting with your silly game that you called a business. That's how it works. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.